final entity in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one would be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading selected chapters from What the University of North Carolina Meant to Me, by Albert Coates, Professor Emeritus, Law School, UNC Chapel Hill. Chapter 1. What Smithfield and Johnston County Meant to Me. Beginnings. Let me start this story with my grandfather, John Rufus Coates, who lived in Pleasant Grove Township, raised 10 children, and, with their labor and his management, accumulated 3,000 acres of good farmland. He divided this land among his children when they came of age, giving each of them 300 acres, with a small frame house, a barn, a mule, a plow, a one-horse wagon, and a cook stove. My father went out to live on his 300 acres when he was 21 years old, batched it, as the saying went, until he got one crop ahead, and then got married. In middle age, he moved to a farm 2 miles south of Smithfield, mainly, I believe, because he saw he was not going to be able to acquire enough land to start his children out with farms of their own, as he had been started. So, he decided to move near a good school, where his children could get a good education, as a substitute. It was in January 1902 that he made this move. Those days were horse and buggy days. The first automobile I ever saw, when I was 10 years old, was a Maxwell Roadster. It was driven by J.D. Spears, a dry goods merchant in Smithfield, with whom our family traded. He drove out to our house and took the family for rides by turns. I rode on the running board. My father and mother would take their annual trip up the country in a horse and buggy to visit kinfolk in the old neighborhood. This was in the day of the stock law, when people fenced in their farms and let the hogs and cattle run free. I was taken along, riding in the rumble seat of the buggy, to open gates which crossed the road every mile or two. The roads consisted of two ruts, through sand, clay, or gravel as it came. Crossing creeks and over wooden bridges, it was wide enough for only one vehicle at a time. In the old neighborhood, the roads were kept up, as they said, by the neighbors, who were called out to work on the roads for 2 or 3 days once or twice a year. This was usually done on rainy days, when it was too wet to plow, but not too wet to bring out the guns and dogs for rabbit hunting, or the shovels and spades for road work. By this time, however, convicts and chain gangs with guards armed with loaded shotguns had replaced the old neighborhood road repair system. The word traffic had not been invented to describe the passage of occasional buggies and wagons drawn by mules, horses, and now and then by oxen. Passing was the word. Often I would walk the 2 mile distance to and from school, morning and afternoon, without meeting anyone to catch a ride with. One summer, the lumber mill at the edge of Smithfield bought a lot of firewood in the Sanders Chapel section, 2 miles on the other side of our home, and offered farmers between the two towns $2 a load to haul lumber one way and firewood the other. 4 loads a day would bring in $8, unheard of money, which farmers could use. When crops were laid by, my father gave me 2 mules and a wagon for this hauling job. The mules soon learned the way between starting and stopping points, and would turn to the right without being told to on meeting another team and wagon. The driver could go to sleep along the way without running much risk. There were telephones in town, but none in the country, and I remember when the lines were extended several miles beyond the city limits. The farmers out our way hauled the poles for the lines and helped dig the post holes. Then came the day when the lines were opened. It was a free-for-all. For the first time in their lives, people scattered miles apart could get together without leaving home, and they did. It was a great cultural and economic event, though we did not use those words to describe it. There was no such thing as the right to privacy on a party line. People with no interest in keeping up with public affairs developed an all-absorbing interest in private affairs. The private loves, hates, quarrels, and courtships of neighbors soon became public affairs. One neighbor even put his telephone at the head of his bed so he could reach the receiver and listen after going to bed at night. News of births, marriages, illnesses, deaths, picnics, watermelon parties, and hayrides spread through the neighborhood on the telephone line. Children would race with each other to answer the phone and feel the magic of a voice coming over the wire. Home and Farm. The home to which my father brought us in 1902 was an antebellum home set upon a sloping plain a quarter of a mile from the road. A path lined with ancient oaks and elms spreading over a carpet of grass led to a front yard with two huge magnolia trees in the right and left corners, and between them two crepe myrtle trees, almost as large. The path through the yard to the front steps was lined with rows of small boxwood bushes. Two tremendous boxwood bushes grew on opposite sides of the path. The whole yard was bordered with giant evergreens, and the grounds were spotted with rose bushes, sweet Betsy bushes, snowballs, and arborvitae. Set in the center of this arrangement was a large, square, two-story house, with porches running the length of each side, and backed by the woodpile and the biggest, oldest oak I've ever seen. There was an attic and a stairway to the roof. The roof had a railing around it, and there was a lookout in the center where one could stand and see the surrounding country for miles in all directions. There were six huge square columns in front and four in back, made of heart lumber 2 inches thick and 2 feet wide. Each one was large enough to hold and hide 40 bushels of corn, and one of them had. The corn was put in from the second-floor porch, and the opening was plastered over and painted to conceal the cash from the Yankees coming through. The house was a landmark in the county. Governor Vance had sent Colonel Carter with a detachment of Confederate soldiers to guard it during the latter days of the Civil War. General Wade Hampton had used it for headquarters. So had Wheeler's cavalry officers, and so had General Schofield, a commanding general in Sherman's army. News of Lee's surrender at Appomattox had been brought to Schofield at this house. It was scheduled to be burned in the closing days of the Civil War when Sherman's army came through on its victorious march from Atlanta toward the rendezvous with General Johnston and the surrender of Johnston's army at a junction near Durham. But the house was saved by a coincidence. Colonel Henry Gildersleeve, commanding the 150th New York Infantry, knocked on the door as his troops marched by, and the person who opened it was a woman who had come from New York as governess in the Michener family and had stayed on to marry the plantation owner. They recognized each other as friends and schoolmates in New York in their teens, and so the house was spared. This big house was the living center of a moderately poor and hard-working family, my mother, my father, and their many children. The farm contained 100 or more acres. When it became too large for later owners to keep up, they had sold it to my father. The house, with its large rooms and high ceilings, and the privacy and freedom that separate rooms guaranteed to every member of the family, had an indelible influence on the internal lives and the external relations of us all. People from far away who had once lived there would come and revisit it. People from Smithfield would drive out to show it to their guests. Our schoolmates delighted to come home with us to spend the night, and they were always welcome. There was always room for unexpected guests. My father was an old-fashioned farmer who believed in working in the fields from daylight to dark. This meant that the family would get up before day to get ready for work by sunrise, the womenfolk to cook and put the house in order, the menfolk to feed the hogs and mules and horses, milk the cows, cut stove wood for cooking, and firewood for the fires which burned in the fireplaces in every room on winter nights. At the age of 5 or 6, I was water boy for the hands working in the fields in summer. At 9 or 10, I was promoted to cotton chopper. At 11 or 12, I became plowman. As I grew older, my father assigned me the task of leading the hands in pulling fodder, the object being for him to get everything he could out of me, and for me to get everything I could out of them. This practice was later condemned by labor leaders as the stretch-out system in modern industry. But this condemnation came too late to be of help to me. My father felt that most, if not all, problems could be solved by working harder than yesterday. And in later years, I thought of him when I came across the writing of Hesiod, "Before the doors of excellence, the high gods have ordained sweat." I will never forget my first and last chew of tobacco. The field hands chewed it with such obvious relish that I decided I would try it, despite parental warnings. I cut off a sizable piece from the plug and started chewing. The juices began to flow, and I started swallowing as I did with candy. At that point, I discovered the difference between a swallow and a spit. Sawmill and cotton gin. My father loved to work with machinery. On his farm in Pleasant Grove Township, he had operated a water mill and had ground corn and wheat for his neighbors. On his farm near Smithfield, he built and operated a sawmill and a cotton gin, and I stayed out of school for 2 years at different intervals, working in these enterprises that entered into my education. Meeting all sorts of people from the surrounding territory, hearing their wisecracks, witticisms, and comments on their neighbors and on happenings beyond the neighborhood, sprinkled with good-natured profanity and observations that would not ordinarily be made around women, was a seasoning, maturing, and toughening experience. I became a sort of handyman, filling in at one time or another on every job that needed doing, the sorts of things required of a monkey wrench that fitted any tap. But most of all, I wanted to fire the boiler, run the engine, and keep up the steam that ran the works. And finally, my father let me try it. It turned out to be a lesson in responsibility for a boy who is allowed to do a man's work. I was working in front of the participants and onlookers who were always bringing logs to be sawed and cotton to be ginned. And I was aware of all this, and stretched myself to live up to expectations. There was one moment in this experience that I'll never forget. It was the moment when the belt flew off the governor that regulated the flow of steam from the boiler to the engine, and the engine started running away under the violent pressure of unrestricted power. In a matter of seconds, it would have shaken the engine to pieces and jeopardized the lives and safety of everybody there. For a fleeting instant, I caught my father's eye as he stood at the saw that cut the lumber under his hand, and in the next second, I was running to the center of the danger to cut off the steam from the engine. It was my job. When the engine stopped, I caught my father's eye again. No word was said. He fixed the belt that put the governor back in operation and went on sawing lumber. I knew, my father knew, and everyone around there knew that I was no longer a boy put to doing a man's work. In that moment, I felt that my father was proud of his son, and I was proud of that fact. The Country Church. In the neighborhood where I was born, my father's people were members of the Primitive Baptist Church. There were factions in the neighborhood. My grandfather had been one of the first county commissioners of Johnston County under the Constitution of 1868, a justice of the peace, and a leader in this church. The elder in the congregation became jealous of my grandfather's standing. People would go to him for advice instead of going to the elder, and the elder was just biding his time. One Sunday, at the end of the preaching service, he asked members of the church to remain after the others had gone, and then he explained, "It's about Brother Rufus. He has killed some poor innocent dogs, and I can't find it in my heart to forgive him." My grandfather knew in a flash what that meant. The elder had the votes to oust him from the church, unless he would beg the elder's forgiveness in the public meeting, and even then, the elder might refuse to forgive. When the elder had finished, my father got up and said, "The elder's dogs got into my pasture and started killing my sheep. I tried to call them off, but their lust for blood was so strong they paid no attention to me, and I got my gun and shot them, and I would shoot them again under similar circumstances. While the elder is crying over his poor innocent dogs, he has not found it in his heart to say a word for the poor innocent sheep. If my brethren care more for a hairy-mouthed, fice, sheep-killing dog than they do for me, it is time for me to go." And, according to the procedure laid down by St. Paul, my grandfather stepped out into the aisle, lifted up first one knee and then the other, dusted off each trouser leg, and walked out of the church. I always loved that story. There's another story of a cousin who was a minister in the old church. As a little boy, I visited him one summer, while my uncle Abram Lassiter, on my mother's side, was holding what my cousin called a proselyting meeting in his neighborhood. The religious beliefs of his people placed more emphasis on inspiration coming from the Lord than on education coming from the schools. But Uncle Abram had gone to Davidson College, and higher education was somehow tied up with secular learning and the higher criticism, and both of those were suspected of undermining the faith and putting the immortal soul in imminent danger of damnation beyond the power of hell, calomel, or democracy to resurrect it. The minister of this church was an old man with a strong sense of family ties, and he felt that he ought to put in an appearance at one of Uncle Abram's Presbyterian meetings, even though it was a proselyting meeting. Switching communicants from one church to another was like one private enterprise taking cash customers from another. Uncle Abram was highly pleased at this appearance, and at the end of his sermon, with his softest voice and most cordial manner, he asked the old minister to lead the congregation in prayer. "No, sir," the old minister exclaimed as he stood up and walked out of the meeting house. He explained his action to me with this observation. "He wasn't preaching from inspiration. I saw him when he turned his notes." I recall one memorable morning in the old minister's church. There had been a doctrinal split in the congregation, with Elder Blank leading his faction in one direction and the old minister leading his faction in another. Elder Blank had advertised a meeting in the town of Coates for that Sunday afternoon, and it was to be a proselyting meeting of a sort. It was something like a stockholders' tug-of-war for control of the corporate body. The old minister figured the best defense was an offense, and he went on the offensive in the morning meeting of his members. "I understand that Mr. Blank, you notice I didn't say preacher, is going to speak, you notice I didn't say preach, at 3 o'clock this afternoon. You notice that this is not the church hour. I know that some of you call me Pope," he said this with great pride and satisfaction, "but I want to say to you here and now that any member of this church is free to go and listen to Mr. Blank speak at the schoolhouse at 3 o'clock this afternoon if you want to. But I want every one of you to know that if you go, I can't fellowship you any longer." He then dismissed the congregation with the satisfied smile of a man who knows he is sitting in the driver's seat. That was my first lesson in free speech, and it helped me in later years to understand the implications of the doctrine of prior restraint in the United States Supreme Court. I heard him preach a sermon on the text, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork," which I remember across a span of 50 years. He preached from inspiration and not from scholarship, and from experience rather than research, but with an insight, power, and beauty that have stayed with me to this day. School teachers. I was 5 years old when we moved from the farm in Pleasant Grove Township, where I was born on August 25, 1896. I started school at Turlington Institute in Smithfield, a private school founded by Ira Turlington in 1891. In 1903, Turlington Institute became Turlington Graded School, the public school of Smithfield, supported by public funds. I walked 2 miles to this school for 11 years. It was my introduction to book learning, and something more. Miss Katie Lee Banks and Miss Lena Rose taught me in the primary grades. Little children loved them, and in the process of loving them, learned to read and write and spell and maybe other things without knowing or caring how or why. I would take them magnolias from the trees in our front yard in the spring. In my eyes, they gave a standing to the men they married. To me, N.B. Grantham was not so much the merchant as he was the husband of Miss Lena Rose. And Dr. S.D. McPherson, I am sure, was privileged to look into my eyes, ears, nose, and throat in later years, partly at least, because he was the husband of Miss Katie Lee Banks. There was also Miss Betty Lee Sanders, who taught me in grammar school and showed a human warmth to her students that I remember to this day. The teachers who meant the most to me in later years were those whose personalities came through the interstices in the subject matter of their teaching and helped me to go beyond the words and read between the lines. There was Miss Rena Bingham, who taught me in the 7th grade. I do not remember the specific courses I studied in her classroom, but I remember to this day the qualities of fairness, balance, serenity, common sense, judgment, and level-headedness which came to us from her living presence. I saw those qualities illustrated in later years when her husband died and left her with 2 small boys and the Smithfield Herald. She rejected offers, good offers, to buy the Herald or put it out of business because she wanted to keep the paper for the boys. She didn't scare easily. Without newspaper experience, she became a first-rate newspaper woman. 2 years after she took over the Smithfield Herald, it won the Savory Loving Cup for general excellence in the non-daily newspaper field, and in the years that followed, it won a succession of awards from the North Carolina Press Association for news coverage, editorial work, and community service. She guided her paper through Depression days, saw circulation drop to 1,500 and rise to 7,500, and kept it for the boys. Without financial resources to draw on outside her paper, she stayed in business, while the rival paper, with financial resources, went out. There was Ira Turlington, born and raised in Johnston County, son of a rural schoolteacher. He went to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, newly reopened in 1875, graduated in 1882, came back to Johnston County, and threw his life into the struggle to bring more and better education to the children of Smithfield and Johnston County. He helped establish private schools to extend the teaching time from a month to 6 weeks, to 4 months, to 6 months, and finally to 9 months. He turned his own privately operated Turlington Institute, with its record of excellence and its drawing power from the surrounding counties in eastern North Carolina, into the Turlington Graded School of Smithfield, expanded it to 9 months and 11 grades, and paved the way for county schools to follow his example. He became so much a part of the lives of his students and neighbors that they were naming children for him 40 years after his death. His qualities of perseverance, dedication, and discipline came across to me through his beginning course in Latin grammar in the 9th grade, his daily administration of school affairs, and his manner and bearing on the school grounds was. No recital of Ira Turlington's impact would be complete without the inclusion of his wife, Hortense. She blended with his personality and moved in his orbit, and at the same time, she kept a personality and moved in an orbit of her own. She was not teaching any one of the grades while I was a student in the school, but she was filling in at all grades when the regular teachers were out for one reason or another. She had to be ready to teach anything in any grade, from the primary department through high school. She could do it, and did do it, with a distinction and a style that singled her out in any company. In later years, when I read Wordsworth's description of a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, I thought of her. Not that she took a moralistic tone, but that she jarred me out of any complacency I might have had, shook me out of any creature comforts I might have enjoyed, and stirred me to lift an ordinary performance beyond ordinary levels and keep it there. She taught me what she knew, and, more than that, she taught me what she was. There was Adolf Vermont, a Belgian by birth. He had been in training for the Catholic priesthood, became an instructor in Romance languages at the University of North Carolina, fell in love with a black-eyed girl named Effie Temple in Chapel Hill, and gave up his priestly calling to marry her. He was unable to live and raise a family on the salary of an instructor at the university in the early 1900s, and came to Smithfield to follow Ira Turlington as superintendent of the Turlington Graded School. He brought a new dimension into the lives of the students in that school, from the first grade through the 11th, and a new flavor into the life of the people of the community where he lived and worked from 1912 to 1918. He had studied, traveled, and taught in many countries, brought with him a reputed mastery of many languages, and knew the literature, life, and religion of many countries. He brought a versatility and a reach that helped him to teach any subject in any grade, and he broadened student horizons in all of them. I got from him a love of English literature, and Latin literature for me was a course both in Virgil and in Mr. Vermont, who seemed sandaled with wind and with flame and could tread on the grass or the stars. He breathed the very spirit of romance and was a living symbol of noblesse oblige, of God and the glory never care for gain. Ability was there, and discipline, and character, and stamina, and dedication, and those qualities were caught up in a larger context, and an enthusiasm for the joy of life, and the contagion of learning. All of these things came through to me from a vibrant personality that inspired all of us who were privileged to touch the hem of his garment. He taught me what he knew, and, more than that, he taught me what he was. Schooling outside of school. In later years, I realized that my schooling began before I started to school. I am told that it began as soon as I was born alive and spanked into being. I became aware of it as I became conscious of my mother and father and sisters. I prayed for a brother and finally got him. There was no such thing as irrelevance in what went on in this kindergarten of assorted personalities, with no two children alike. Here I learned my first lessons in the art of adjusting differences and resolving problems, in the philosophy of live and let live, in the world of free competition and private enterprise, in which every member of the family was taught to pull his own weight and a little more, with a built-in system of regulation and enforcement which was at the same time ruthless, healing, and effective. The middle child of a large family, I was broken into the decencies and amenities of responsible living and made ready for the public school grounds. It was an experience which points out the possibilities in the beginning kindergarten programs in the schools today. This schooling was continued and broadened at a school in Smithfield, to which hundreds of children came from their homes in the town and surrounding county, bringing a variety of backgrounds, representing all degrees of poverty and wealth, and having different attitudes and points of view. On the school grounds, these children met and mingled, rubbed off rough edges on each other in study and play, felt the thrill of individual effort as they matched their wits and strength of body and mind against each other, and learned to size each other up for what they were. In this mixing process, they began to learn lessons in the art of living and working and playing together, which would carry over into the community, both while they were in school and after they had left it. In my own class, there were Oliver and Walter Rand, Robert and William Wellens, Ed Woodall, Gardner Hudson, and Irene Myatt, who for 11 years stayed near enough to the head of the class to relieve us of any notion we might have had that boys had more sense than girls. If the public school is the community writ small, the community is the public school writ large. Every community throughout the land of North Carolina is born again in every generation of students coming out of its schools. These students and classrooms and school grounds and school teachers have extended the schooling processes begun in the homes and have been the seedbeds of democracy and the laboratories for the development of whatever we have of civilized living in North Carolina. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.